Thank you, Steve, for the introduction. Actually, you raised some very interesting points in terms of the state of the market. Maybe I'll try to also set the scene very quickly, but in the meantime, just to introduce our panelists, we have Michael from LGT, Jessica from Nephila Capital, Raffaele, Cambridge Associates, and Evelyn, PGGM. You all have the program. If you're interested in the bios, you can read them there. So, as Steve mentioned, you know, we basically had a very strong year last year on the insurance market, benefited from it, but on top of that, most importantly, all the investors enjoyed 3 years of consecutive strong returns. And these strong returns were supported by insured catastrophic losses estimated by Aon at around $126 billion, which was below the historical 10-year average of $138 billion. Now, 90% of these losses were caused by secondary perils. So those were, if you were, you know, we were discussing last year at the same time about the, unfortunately, about the Los Angeles wildfires. Then we had a number of convective storms, which tornadoes caused a lot of losses, floods. But most importantly, we didn't see any major landfall of hurricanes or typhoons in the US or Japan. However, Hurricane Melissa made landfall in the Caribbean and caused the trigger of one catastrophe bond exposed to Jamaica. Now, today we're here actually to discuss more about private placement, so that's going to be the focus. Now, what this meant is that at the most recent reinsurance renewals, 1st of January, we've seen pricing softening, and Steve made the point about the cycle of reinsurance and the premiums. And the premiums decreased by approximately 12% according to the rate or line index from Guy Carpenter. Now, this is more for primary reinsurance. If we look at retrocession, it was probably more 15 to 20%. Now, this decreasing premium, though, brought back the level of pricing at where we were in 2022. And according to the Guy Carpenter rate or line index, we are still approximately 70% higher than the most recent bottom of the market, which was 2017. So this has translated in very strong retained earnings from reinsurers. In the meanwhile, as Steve mentioned, we had a decent amount of flow of capital coming into the market, mostly chasing the liquid part of the market, catastrophe bonds. And these have helped to lift the overall alternative capital to over $126 billion. So this is to say that whilst we are in a softening market, it's important to remember that the cycle, we are still in the part of the cycle that's extremely attractive. And most importantly, we are not back to the underwriting standards typical of a soft cycle that were applied in 2017. We'll discuss this today with our panelists. You know, attachment points remain much higher, which is very important. Terms and conditions are tighter, and the allocation of capital is way more selective than it used to be. So with that in mind, and this is just to reassure the investors that the opportunity is still there. So with that in mind, I'll pass it over to Michael, thinking about all these inflows of capital. You know, is it this new money? Is it money coming from investors that are already allocated? Or have we ever seen, or have you seen any investor that exited in the past and now is back, for example?
So on our end, I think it's a mix of everything. What we mustn't forget, and you already mentioned it, we've had now 3 consecutive years with very strong returns. Most of the funds retain their earnings and reallocate their earnings. So that already leads to an increased asset position that needs to be deployed. And that is already pushing sort of a bit on the price side. In terms of inflows, what we have seen is, we all know cat bond strategies have seen massive inflows over the recent years. We believe that's mostly due to the fact that people just look at the sort of short-term past performance and view this as a most attractive space. We see a bit of a challenge, and it's also what I hear from my competitors, in raising money in what we would call blended strategies, where we allocate to cat bonds and to private transactions. And then, interestingly enough, on the more, I would say, difficult structures, sidecar structures, equity positions in newly founded reinsurance companies, there, raising capital is, again, easier. So it's really this middle part, the blended strategies, where we currently still see limited flows. And maybe just the last comment on this. Again, on our end, I think that's a bit short-sighted by investors, because they, of course, look at these blended strategies, and then they see that some of these strategies have had their challenges in the years 17, 18, 20, with elevated loss activity. But at that point in time, I think the market has evolved. You mentioned a couple of the elements, you know, structures have become more robust, focus on occurrence. Yes, all of that, but there's something else that happened. In the years 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, when the new money on the alternative side started to get into the market, the focus was on single shot covers. So a lot of the ILS managers did not have the capability of offering traditional reinsurance that comes with a reinstatement. So they had to focus on single shot covers. And the easiest single shot cover was a frequency cover. So the brokers were introducing aggregate frequency covers into the market, single shot covers. That's where the market went. The short-term performance track of these deals looked good, and so a lot of the money went into that space. That has changed completely. And again, I don't think I speak for ourselves only. If we look at the allocation to frequency and aggregate covers, that has seen a massive reduction. And not just because some of the funds got burned to a certain degree, it's really down to the fact that now we can offer rated paper, fronted structures. The market has evolved.
Thanks, Michael, and we'll come to that. Jessica, what's your view?
I mean, a lot of similar observations. I think 2023 would be a really good case study on sort of for behavioral finance. You know, the market's at all-time high pricing, and there is a lot of capital that just wasn't willing to take a call. They just weren't willing to listen. And I think a lot of that was an expectation that the market couldn't get ahead of pricing with fears around climate change, recency bias, like you touched on, and also just structural elements of the market. You know, we viewed this asset class, even in private ILS, as having a reasonable amount of liquidity, not as much as the cat bond market, but a year to 2 year duration. And you were seeing a lot of side pockets really negate that, and capital was trapped for longer periods. So the market reassessed its view of risk and went way up, but it still didn't pull in all of that sort of strategic capital. You saw a lot more opportunistic capital make their way in to try to take advantage of it. What you did see, I guess, is some of the cat bonds, obviously, which had a pretty clean track record through that period, the perception of liquidity. Obviously, we've seen a lot of draw of capital there. And slowly, I think, we're seeing that tilt shift. Strategics are starting to slowly come back in, but not at the same pace that we've seen them before. I think as the market naturally softens on the back of good performance and a lot of structural enhancements, opportunistic capital may no longer meet their cost of capital, and you may see that slowly retreat, at which pace we expect some of the strategics to come back in. So I think it's still a developing story, but certainly on the characteristics of the type of capital, it's been relatively quiet on the strategic side and definitely more activity on the opportunistic side within the private ILS space.
Thanks, Jessica. So, Raffaele, looking back at 2025, in your opinion, what were the key drivers for the strong performance of the private ILS? Most importantly, what could go wrong?
What could go wrong in future?
In the future, of course. Wow. Fast is done.
Well, nature decides usually what goes wrong, right? For society first and then for investors. I think that's a key part of the business. But what were the driver of a very good year, obviously, was the healthy premium environment. I think that was clear. As Jessica mentioned, we get there because there is less capital that is willing to take, despite the premium advisor was there where it is. So there was this fear element that, is it enough, given what we have experienced in the past? And it resulted that it was probably at all-time high, at least looking backwards. So starting from there, and then nature was relatively benign, or at least in those areas where the largest exposures are for this particular asset class, that resulted in a very, very good year. Plus, I think that's also a point that needs to be made, is that structurally, the asset class has evolved given, let's say, the lowest level 2017, not only in terms of facts and figures, pricing and losses, but also in terms of structure and the way of gauging capital efficiency in terms of structural leverage, in terms of balance sheet leverage, in terms of fronting agreements. So this has evolved and allows to guide more or less risk given where the market is. And I think that is key going forward, and answer now the second part of your question, what could go wrong? It could go wrong that we repeat, let's say, the same mistakes that we have done in the past, if you will, so, or we don't get fully enough the lessons learned, which means we say here portfolio discipline. I'm struggling a bit with discipline in the sense that to me, discipline tells me you do always and all the time the same thing, right? Personally, I'm not that type of person. But that said, you should navigate the cycle. So technically, on paper, you should have taken as much risk as possible within your guidelines and framework and risk appetite, for sure, 24, 25, because that's what basically the market told you. And subsequently, you should probably think about getting off the gas pedal now and probably going forward, because that's what the market keeps telling us, right? Now. Well, not at least starting thinking about it, right? Because, you know, when we have another good year, how the market works seems clear to me. The softening cycle, the hardening cycle, the drivers of that. So it's not a big surprise that we've softened now. After three good years, all-time high premium level, that could not continue, right? So I think it's thinking ahead where the market goes and why, and adapting to that rather than just keep doing the same things. I think that's going to be crucial. Those that do that well will probably come out smoother.
Because as an investor, you could simply accept to earn slightly less as a target return if the portfolio managers maintain the same discipline in terms
of... I think here we have...
But
we have
this is maybe for Evelyn.
Exactly.
Given that, you know, you've been leaving the cycle. And so are you accelerating again? Are you taking the gas off?
We're not taking the gas off.
Okay, good.
I think we... we did give back quite a lot of capital to our clients, so we were very much overweight in 2023, which actually was a great place to be over-allocated in. So over the last 3 years, we gave back, say, about 3 billion of capital, and we tried to postpone that as much as possible. So for 2023, we thought, okay, we tried not to give it back. We waited. And ultimately, I think last year and this year, most of the capital will be returned to our client.
What are you most worried about?
I think for the future, in order to preserve the very attractive returns that we saw, I'm most worried about attachment points coming down again. I think that would be by far the biggest challenge that we would see. Clearly, rates are coming down, which makes sense, but also I think at a certain point that has to stabilize. Terms and conditions, there is some flexibility, but also there we need to, if that materially changes from where it is today, that would also affect, I think, future returns. And then finally, if the re-entrance of frequency covers comes into our market, I think we... Those at least need to be very well structured in order for us to take a good look at it. And another risk is that the contamination of property cat treaties with man-made risks, we will try to avoid that as much as possible.
Okay.
So those are the risks. But,
Jessica, we're approaching, obviously, we are all targeting the next renewals. We have Japan coming up, and then later, you know, 1st of June, 1st of July is the key for all of us. So what are expectations there in terms of pricing? Remembering that the cycle is always this 1 year, so we obviously observe the January renewals, but now we observe the next renewals, which go back 1 year. So anyway, I shouldn't answer.
Yeah. Let you answer. Leading question. Look, I think we're going to see persistence in what we observed at 1-1. Florida is a different market. Speaking more to sort of the June 1 southeast wind, Florida renewal in particular. I'll touch on Japan quickly afterwards. But I think you're going to see persistence. As we said, there's been a lot of reasons why rates are coming off. People's reassessment of risk is coming down in a rational way. We've had great years of performance. More capital's moving into the space. That's a natural thing to do. Florida has some unique dynamics to it. They've obviously got the Citizens has been seeing a lot of takeouts, right? You've gone from over 1 million policies to under 400,000 policies. Like, that's moving back to the private market. There's a signal there telling us the private market is seeing more confidence in the reforms. They're willing to take that risk back. The amount of reinsurance protection private market needs to buy relative to what Citizens chooses to buy is quite different. So there's that, FHCF moving up. There's a number of different factors that I think are going to lead to some increase in demand that might put a little bit more pressure around rates in Florida than perhaps we saw at some of the blue chip nationwide writers at January 1. I still think the persistence of bifurcation between the more risk remote parts of the tower and perhaps the more volatile parts of the tower are going to continue to be seen. Capital still seems to be flowing into the cat bond market from a number of different small players, but it's, you know, $60 billion market. It's less than 10% of the overall reinsurance market. So you're really going to feel that pressure there. It's going to have some knock-on effects to traditional reinsurance towers. I think as it relates to Japan, I mean, particularly with the valuation of the yen, there's and no additional demand coming out of that part of the market. It's not really growing. In fact, it's probably contracting mildly. So there's going to be increased pressure there. And I think having discipline and recognizing where there's rate adequacy is going to be really important to focus on there, since they've been coming off for a while now, a number of consecutive renewals. So a little bit more of the same. And again, I think it's still a very healthy market for the avoidance of doubt. We think there's plenty of excess return, but we're going to be focused on targeting the parts of the market that we think are offering the most value.
And Rafael, any views on that?
No. I mean, it seems that, as Jessica mentioned, there are no particular reason why this 1-4 renewal is probably going to be materially different than what we just experienced. I think that's just where we are right now in the overall cycle. That's probably the variation seem to be, at least historically, seem to be to a lesser extent, given that business is slightly lower, it's more stable in Japan and that area. So probably less softening in terms of just figures amount, but in the trend, I believe that's what we're going to experience. So, and that plays a little bit in terms of how do I want to guide my portfolio and thinking already a little bit ahead. So to me, or to our clients, it's more about consistency rather than discipline, in the sense that they understand that the market is now different than 24 or 25. But what do we do now differently than in 2024 or 2025 or 2017, right? So these are the questions that are very important to us and to our clients.
Okay, thanks. Well, let's introduce my next question for Evelyn, which is about terms and conditions, which of course have improved materially since 2017. Are there any specific changes regarding wordings, exclusions, hour clauses, loss reporting that you like most or that you're worried about?
I think the major improvements indeed were clearly higher attachment points, leading to a good split of losses between insurance and reinsurance companies, as well as the disappearance of the frequency covers. So the X, the top and drops, the second and third events. I think the other element that that caused the great hard market was clearly rates. So rate on lines very high, fully paid reinstatements, and finally kind of a stricter exclusions for non-bait, non-natural perils. So,
Michael?
Well, I think I could just echo what Evelyn said. In addition, what we mustn't forget is part of the hardening of the market was also linked to the fact that insurance companies were able to push through higher premiums on the incoming side. So they did receive a higher premium income that supported their own balance sheet and they supported their own and affected their own risk-taking ability. So they were clearly interested in assuming more risk and retaining more of the earnings. And that, of course, then led to the higher attachment points. And we do see this still to continue. So we do see that insurance companies also, again, on the back of okay years for insurance companies at times, depending on where you are active, some of the years, 25, 24, were maybe not that good. There was, you already alluded to that at the beginning, there was quite some second event activity, risk activity, so things that did not attach to the reinsurance programs but did affect the balance sheets of the insurance companies. But we're quite confident that the attachment levels remain firm. The only thing that do we see is that maybe not, it's terms and conditions, but maybe more the placement strategy, we do see that insurance companies increasingly now expect for their reinsurance partners and ILS managers on the private side to participate broader on the program. So 23, 24, in the very hard market cycle, we were able to pick and choose the optimal positioning, and now they would expect you to either be a broader partner along the whole structure, or you might not be able to continue your participation. So there is clear push for that. And I have to admit that we rather give in a bit on that and are showing our partnership before we start to really push down pricing too much and start to soften the condition.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that frequency is definitely something that has hit everyone back in the days. And if you think about the overall level of industry losses last year, you know, $125 billion, if we went back 10 years ago, probably a lot of portfolios would have been affected, right?
Yeah.
And whereas today, you know, we are all clean, which is amazing how this sector has evolved in terms of the discipline of the underwriting. Jessica, please.
I was just going to add, too, when we talk about attachment levels and the insurance market being able to generate more premium, a lot of the actual reason that came about is because we started seeing or paying a lot more attention to valuations. That was a huge culprit of the model miss, which eroded a lot of investor confidence from that period of loss years. You're expecting to, you know, perform X, but you were performing Y negatively, losing this, expecting this. And where was that model miss coming from? A lot of that was valuation. So if you're putting a home through your cat models at 300,000, but you're actually paying out losses at 500 or 600, you're underestimating the risk, you're not charging enough premium, you're going to see model miss, and it means your attachment points are going to look, you know, more remote than they actually were. So in effect, you're not attaching at 1 in 7, it's 1 in 5 or 1 in 3 at some point. So I think losing sight of that, or now that we've, you know, eyes are wide open to that, staying disciplined on that. So even if attachment levels held constant this renewal, insurance value inflation is still going up 3-5 points this year. So inherently, retentions are actually still, attachment points are still moving around a little bit, and that may be okay if we're charging for it and the market recognizes that's happening, but holding discipline around that and making sure that valuation is sort of front and center in terms of risk assessment, I think is going to be important to not repeat mistakes of the past.
I think what Jessica also mentioned is that the recent model updates, I think, also helped with confidence. So the wildfire model, the severe convective storm model, clearly with much higher risk or view of risk than were ever before. And a lot of the partners that we work with already either feel that that view of risk of the vendor models have come closer to theirs, or some even make adjustments on top of that. But just the acceptance of this change in the market, I think, also helps when it comes to discipline in pricing secondary barrels.
So you know, last year you were, I'm not sure whether upset is the right comment about the Los Angeles wildfires, right? And the fact that different managers have different views on the attractiveness of the risk. So how has your perception changed since last year? I mean, what has been the lessons learned?
It's a good question. I think for me, I think today there is maybe a more consistent approach and fewer risk for those wildfires than maybe a couple of years ago. So we see kind of convergence of that risk. I think we also needed to kind of recalibrate our expectations when it came to frequency, severity, and with wildfire particularly also the mitigation of loss, which was clearly different than expected. And what we do is that we do due diligence our partners, we assess mainly how they have incorporated the lessons learned from the industry in their underwriting and in their decision-making processes.
So you're still long of wildfire?
We still have it in portfolio, yes, but we try not to, not that pronounced.
Okay, not overweighted.
No, clearly not overweighted.
Irrespective of the reprise.
Yeah, we respect the peril.
Okay, a lot of respect, fair enough. Michael, what's your view actually on the wildfire risk and since last year?
Well, we failed. The level of loss that we suffered from within our portfolios was very much in line with expectations. Needless to say, the clean rest of the year helped tremendously, and so there was no real mismatch between expected returns and actual returns. We did renew the positions. What we did see is that some mid-sized reinsurance companies, I think they some of those companies, from what we have seen, what we've heard, is that they have exceeded their expectations. They've had a bigger loss than they would want it to have, and some of them have cut down their allocations, and that really left a bit of a mini sort of hardening in pricing. And then also, to Evelyn's point, the structures, the risk assessment, the modeling improved as well, and so we rolled and renewed.
Jessica, I assume you guys are backing wildfires.
It proved to be a huge opportunity in the market, right? By definition, capital was leaving it. People's view of risk shot way up. And I think if you can make a sound risk assessment through, obviously there's the vendor models, but your own view of risk and your own performance, do you understand it? Are they performing in line with expectations? So if you have sound risk assessment and capital is leaving an area of the market, it creates a forum for opportunity. And so if you can lean into that, and again, for our investors, ILS is a diversifying return stream. So being idiosyncratic in a specific area, as long as you can demonstrate, again, good risk assessment and rate adequacy, in fact, excess margin, you're paid for that concentrated risk, there can be a lot of alpha that you can harvest for investors. So, yes, just because there's been a loss, I think the first step is, do we understand why there was a loss? Do we feel confident in our view of that risk?
Okay. Well, actually, at Leaden, we have a different view, but we keep our position as underweighted, and we think that sometimes still not compensated enough for the risk we're taking. But that's the beauty of this sector, right? Ultimately, we're all here having different views and different way of supporting the market. Now, Steve made the point at the beginning about the geopolitical environment, volatility that is increasing, interest rates are going down. So, Raffaele, in the context of the portfolio, how do you see ILS for investors? Have they shifted their view? Until probably last year, you would look at any portfolio of an investor would look at ILS, think, oh, at an absolute level, we're going to get a return which is stellar. Today, the return is still attractive, it's not as stellar as last year. So maybe it's more about relative value. So what's your view?
Yes, they indeed thought that. And then it was last year, probably at this time of the year, where the tariff kind of shook a little bit the market. And, one side of the medal is that the attention then goes to what has the highest priority. And in these weeks, obviously, it was about finding out what the overall portfolio, how will that actually react to this type of environment. And so at Cambridge, we had good momentum with ILS, and actually the tariffs kind of making the case for ILS, but brought the attention back to where the portfolio was impacted in the overall sense. So that's also an aspect that needs to be considered. Whilst the case is kind of restated and enforced, sometimes just side effects may have different impacts on getting the attention that it deserves. That said, I think it was, again, ILS always, ILS as a strategic kind of case, we all know, and that's why also we are kind of part here. What the timing part of it, how can I optimize that type of allocation, needs to be a bit considered more thoughtfully in advance. Because when we start the education process after such an event like in January, it usually takes months. We all know months is already quite fast, if not, you know, 12 months, years. And so the opportunity might have changed. So our lessons learned internally in our Cambridge is really to educate clients already or kind of constantly, independent of where the cycle is, independent of really what the absolute attractiveness is, making the case, look, there is a strategic case for that. The relative value is probably constantly always there. Mm-hmm. Diversification, kind of really independent from any type of market impact. And even on a second and third order, you know, inflation, hedge, floating, you name them, right? And so to be able then to exploit the opportunities when they are there. So that's one aspect. And second aspect, are we kind of successful in making the case that the current environment will be less impactful on ILS than on other asset classes? Yes, we are. That said, you know, obviously then people start to think what could go even worse than what happened now. And I think we discussed this also internally, right? The current administration is difficult to read in terms of where it goes. Tariff was one. Is there anything else that might come and kind of be more targeted to reinsurance? We don't feel that yet. I wouldn't imagine that that's a big case. And that said, also, it probably we don't expect any kind of major impact from the current geographic or kind of environment across the political world on ILS. So in essence, it strengthened the case per se on paper and like in fact. It deviates though attention to where the overall investment portfolio of large clients are impacted, which is not helpful, right? So it's a bit balanced.
Evelyn, do you agree? Is there any other worries that you want to raise?
So for us, ILS is a very strategic allocation. So the current geopolitical environment, it's not changing the allocation overnight, and even also not long term. I think, as said, ILS should be one of the categories where there's actually very low correlation to economics in general, volatility of markets. So that would, ultimately be in favor of the asset class. However, I think the current environment is concerning, and not only for ILS, but for everything, for all strategies that are out there. And I think for ILS, we constantly monitor the situation. We have had some calls with some managers on the just to figure out whether they see a heightened risk for example, collateral and premium safety. So we just took it as an opportunity to took another good look at our structures, because I think, as always, in these situations, structures should hold as they were supposed to, and then we should be fine.
No more CDOs, and it's a joke, by the way. Okay, good. Michael, anything else you want to add on geopolitical risk?
Well, I think in addition to what Evelyn just said, the management of the collateral is always a discussion point within our firm and amongst our investors. And we do have, especially we have a lot of European investors, and European investors have increasingly asked about replacements for US dollar treasury bills. The challenge for us is that, first of all, we're quite confident that the US dollar treasury bill is a decent form of collateral. especially given that the majority of the revenue streams in the funds are US dollar related. And so it is also a good match in terms of just the general revenue streams. That's one of the points. Then the second point is where we see a bit more of a challenge. It's not a concern, but a challenge is the FX hedge. So given we have euro investors, we have pound investors, we have Swiss franc investors, yen investors, and then we're hedging their allocation. If they choose to go into a hedged solution, we're hedging the allocation to the US dollar. And the recent changes in valuation between the US dollar and those currencies has led to, at times, substantial liquidity flows, so inflows in that case, which then needs to be reallocated. But we all know it can also be the other way around. So the managing the liquidity around the FX hedges has become, I wouldn't say a challenge, but it's something that we are more concerned about than we were in the past.
Fair enough. So another area that I assume all ILS managers have been focusing over the last 20 years has been to improve the way that investors can assess insurance risk, right? So when we're talking about innovation here, and Michael made the point about for private deals, how much collateral is now needed to post against each deal. So maybe Jessica, if you don't mind, to cover, you know, what are the innovations that we've seen, anything else that we should expect to improve this efficiency for investors to enter our space and make more money.
I mean, I think a lot of where the efficiencies have come from and sort of the structural enhancements that we've seen in the space have been generating more balance sheet tools and resources for sort of private ILS, what was fully collateralized in the past. So capital efficiency in the form of leverage could be other forms of collateral that you can post. I think liquidity has been a huge one as well. I mentioned earlier, we saw how long a side pocket could last from after the period of 2017 to 2022. So finding ways or markets that are interested in that development risk as a way to transfer that liability to give finality and a clear exit timeline within, you know, a year after, an underwriting year, could be a valuable tool for investors, and I think what they're seeking is greater certainty around liquidity. So capital efficiency and liquidity, I think, are probably two of the biggest enhancements that we've seen to the space that I think is drawing more interest and engaging more investors towards private ILS.
Michael, anything else you want to add?
Well, I think ultimately what we see is an increased demand for leverage and gearing solutions, where investors are demanding whether we could structure solutions whereby they only inject part of the money and then get a broader allocation based on their structure. And clearly, that is possible. There are solutions around this, but that always comes with risk, and someone has to take that risk, and someone has to be willing to price that level of risk. So if you offer a solution with a stop-loss mechanic, then at times it's an interesting discussion around the pricing for such a solution. Thankfully, there's a market out there, so you can also obtain third-party quotes. But this is where we currently see the highest demand for levered allocations.
Okay, and maybe just to clarify, we're talking about underwriting leverage here, but we've seen also in the carbon market that there is obviously the ability to lever in terms of getting additional debt, you know, against the portfolio. Excellent. Raffaele, is there anything that you want to mention about the innovation of the market and or solutions that you would have hoped to see already and you haven't seen in the market?
No, I think I would echo exactly what was discussed. I think it's just the natural convergence of the reinsurance business versus the ILS business in terms of gaining capital efficiency. The liquidity requirements probably coming more from the asset management world, let's say. In the reinsurance world, liquidity is not that type of an issue, right? Plus, obviously, there is the whole involvement in different perils, which also, if you look at the reinsurance business, we start with NatCat, the property part. We have evolved to the life part. We're coming back to the P&C, now casualty. So it seems that's a natural involvement towards these two segments. And so it's good to see. It obviously increases the level of, let's say, complexity of the asset class for non-experts. It takes more time, it takes more education, and I think what I would like to highlight is probably that one needs to be very careful in what type of solution are offered to which clients, because not all solutions fit all client needs. So I would really raise the attention, listen to the clients, listen what they would like to achieve. Not all risk perils, not all structure, all for all clients. And if we kind of go that path, I think the market will evolve and mature gradually over time, which is probably one of the main objectives of many people in here, I believe.
Evelyn, is there anything on the structuring side that you wish, you know, we would have achieved already and that you're trying to push? Or obviously, you know, your ability to provide collateral overlay, probably, you know, people could take your credit risk.
We tried, and sometimes it works.
promise to pay.
But yes, indeed, it's all about capital efficiency that we spend truly a lot of time and effort into to improve that.
Understanding the seasonality and when the money is needed.
Correct, and that's the beauty about being kind of a large end investor and having the ability to set up dedicated structures for almost everything that you do. We are very flexible in borrowing capital. We can do it overnight, but the same, we have top-up structures designed, backing rated vehicles. I think we have a lot of instruments available to us to make sure that our portfolio is as efficient as possible.
Okay, so it's a clear message for investors that are big and sophisticated, that also from ILS managers there are a lot of solutions that can be provided to make their money work in the most efficient way with flexibility.
Yeah, if you have the capacity to take a look at those, and if you have gain the understanding of those structures, then yes, it can be very profitable to use them. Yes, but I think it's big if you need to have capacity, you need to have the understanding.
Absolutely, it all depends on, you know, how much risk you're willing to take, where you want to play in the capital structure, and how liquid you want your portfolio to be. Now, talking about liquidity, you know, we discussed earlier about cab bonds, and we saw a lot of inflows, and we keep seeing a lot of inflows of money from investors at the same time. You know, Steve made the point that we had another record year for carbon issuance, and I'm sure there will be a panel later talking about it. But the other thing that is noticeable is definitely the decoupling of pricing, right? And now, for the same level of risk, you definitely earn more in a private placement, in a one-year private placement collateralized structure, then, especially when you apply this underwriting leverage that we discussed, right? So what do you expect to see from the market in terms of investors' appetite, Michael?
So on our end, I do think that this is an element that is being more and more recognized. And we are quite confident that this will lead to investors looking again more favorably at less liquid structures that are allocated to private ILS. I do think that the fact that you can see a clear price differentiation between the traded liquid market and private structures should be, it's recognized, it's seen, and should lead to more inflows on the less liquid side. I think the key question is a bit, maybe also for the audience, why is that even the case? Well, you know, if you're a reinsurance buyer, and I was sitting next to a gentleman that will be sitting here in the cap bond panel, I was talking about this, and how quickly can you respond to such price differences? If you are putting together your insurance capital, if you're putting together your regulatory requirement, and you need to decide, where should I issue a cap bond, where should I just buy reinsurance? And the time to market is at times quite long, depending on how also complex your organization is set up. If you're a small company with very sort of quick decision lines, then you could probably do it quicker. But if you are a larger organization, you have a committee, you have a risk management team, you have a CFO, CEO office that you need to also convince of doing a cap bond, and then you once agree on doing a cap bond, it takes 2-3 months to do that deal. And You can play a bit with the size, but the ultimate decision at one point needs to be taken. And the private ILS market, it's trading the way it has always traded. It's very flexible, very easy to access. And I do think that this is where we currently see the reason for the price difference.
Jessica, what's your view?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, if you look at the differential in price, sort of the liquidity premium in you know, private or public equity, you know, and you think that the duration for that is like a 10-year liquidity differential, it's paying north of 400 basis points. Private ILS versus cat bonds is paying virtually the same amount for what's effectively a 1 year versus a effective daily liquidity in the cat bond market. And that's a massive spread differential. It's very easy to calculate same amount of risk. So how important is that liquidity to you as an investor? Or how much is the perception of that liquidity really important? Because the market is clearly offering a significant amount of premium for transacting in private ILS. Particularly with all the enhancements we've talked about around liquidity and being able to get your money back on a timely basis. So, and you can also think about it too, it's not even like a liquidity premium anymore with those solutions. That's basically just excess return for willing to spend time understanding, you know, it's slightly more complicated, it's not as neatly packaged as say a 144A security, but that's quite a lot of money to leave on the table for a very similar risk profile.
And actually, we discussed a lot about liquidity, and maybe it's also interesting to think about how the market has evolved for private placements, because, you know, in the old days, you mentioned side pockets, you know, a lot of investors had to sit on these side pockets for a long period of time, and there's always been this perception that in the carbon market is very liquid, private placement market, you get locked in for a long period of time post-event. However, you know, most investors don't appreciate that actually after an event, the behavior of the two transactions is the same, right? In the carbon market, you have an extension mechanism, which basically is a collateral trapping element as well, with a price which is very distressed. So yes, there is an exit, but it's at the cost. And today, the same is for private placements over insurance. You know, if you accept to take the cost of liquidity, then you can still exit, right? And then, so there is no a big mismatch between the two markets. And with that in mind, you know, what are, again, Jessica, the other barriers that you think are still there for investors to think, hang on a second, private placements make a lot of sense? You know, is it about the complexity, is it education? You know, we reach the point where everyone is very comfortable and we should see a decent amount of money coming in.
Yeah. I mean, education has come a long way from when we started back in 98. I think the market is just at a much higher starting point. Anyone coming in, it's rare you're going to find someone in financial capital markets that hasn't heard of ILS in some capacity before. And Steve's slides showed that, just the number of interest and searching people are doing. I think at this stage, what really is going to continue to improve, or what's needed, it really comes down to trust and being able to demonstrate that you can make money in this asset class. It's performing in line with expectations. So ultimately, I think that comes down to transparency, and not data for data's sake, but data that's actually supporting and showing credibility and risk assessment, that how you expect a portfolio to perform. Can you demonstrate that to an investor beyond just an exceedance probability curve, but in a tangible way that they understand the exposures they're taking, the risk return trade-offs, and then when an event does happen, are the outcomes, you know, comparable and in line with what the expectations were? That's all about building trust and showing that we're thinking about climate change and we're pricing that into our view of risk. We've learned a lot from valuation and Florida reforms and all those other elements that were clearly missing from risk assessment back in 2015, 16, 17. So I think trust, education, which ultimately is only going to be built out of transparency.
Rafael, any view on this topic?
Actually, very important point here, and the comparison of the private equity, public equity is an interesting one. And why does that work, or we believe it works, is, as you just mentioned, there is the evidence that historically it's like this. Actually, private equity is going through some challenges right now, but historically that seems to be the case. Now, what historically happened is, private ILS and capital are right there, right? Depending a bit, every year is slightly different, but over time, we haven't seen that part where private ILS outperformed. First point. Second point, probably are today in an environment where private ILS is more attractive on paper. We need just the evidence and the materialization of that over a certain time period where, as Jessica just mentioned, we gain trust again that, All right, our figures really materialize in the way we expect. Obviously subject to what the market then delivers and nature decides, but it's kind of consistent. And third point, I believe it's really also in the perception of the client. When you talk about cat bonds, I believe the picture of the cat bond market is very consistent across different people, different level of knowledge, expertise, and time they spend in the market. There seems to be a consistent picture. Private ILS is quite dispersed. You can be very close to the capital market in terms of risk profile, or you can be far, far away doing completely something else. And so this needs to be more segmented and clearer what it is, what it does offer, and how it materializes. So that's an additional step and challenge where private ILS, we can do and have to do a better job. Because private ILS is probably not the same as private ILS across different strategies and managers. But cat bond feels like much more similar, much more comparable. So that provides a level of trust where you can actually allocate with much more comfort or easily with comfort. So it goes a little bit what Michi said at the beginning. Raising capital for cat bond seems to be more successful, as well as sidecars or higher risk strategy, where the difference is really clear. Something in between where it's not quite clear, does it really make sense to take the illiquidity for a little bit more? That case is not crystal clear, especially looking backwards. It has to materialize in the coming years, hopefully.
Well, we had three very strong years, right?
Sure, so. Sure. But, you know, when the market is, as it was the last couple of years, nature very benign and premium very high, all perform well, you know. I don't want to quote Warren Buffett. I'm not in that position. But, you know, you see who doesn't wear swimsuits when the tide is low. So that's where we have to perform as a market. Not in absolute terms. Nobody expects high return when nature is not here. But in relative term, expected to model. That's where trust is gained.
Well, in a way, you know, the example I made earlier that despite $125 billion of insurance losses, the market has delivered strong returns. It should already give some confidence to investors that we are getting there, hopefully.
We are much in a better position today than we were in 2017, 18, 19, with for sure. That for sure, exactly. That for sure, no question about that. But it's a start. It's a good start, you know. The ball is, we just kicked off the ball. Let's keep that rolling and not already kind of enjoy the goal. We're not there yet.
And Evelyn probably is a good example of an investor that has been resilient over the cycle for the very long term, right?
Yeah, I think that is, if you decide to invest, I think this is one of the key features to don't miss out the hard market and leave in a soft market. I think that would, and we've seen that happening a lot. We saw investors coming in were severely impacted by the 2017-18 losses and kind of disappeared. And sometimes even people or companies coming back because there has been 3 years of a great track record. Well, that's a pity.
So you brought up maybe the last question before we open up to questions. You brought up the, you know, 2017-18 and the losses, and we all know that Florida had a huge impact, right, to the our results in terms of the loss creep, the deterioration. So maybe, Michael, what has improved since then in Florida and why investors should be more optimistic?
Well, there have been improvements, as we all know, and some of the changes have been very fundamental. I think we're still somewhat hesitant to then fully deploy in Florida. I think Jessica made a very good point earlier. So what we are currently seeing is the restructuring of the Florida market with Citizens passing on a lot of the policies, new privately run insurance companies emerge with at times zero track record, senior staff that may have the expertise, very limited equity positions, heavily reliant on especially then private reinsurance. So I do think that the Florida market is again going through, at least structurally, on how the reinsurance segmentation is currently presenting itself, is going through an interesting time. It will offer opportunities. We are looking at the market. We are, however, still somewhat on the way to Florida, despite the fact that the legislative changes and there has been a certain track record of proof that, yes, those changes are supporting the market and are making it a healthier market. But we're still cautious.
There is still a dispersion of quality, you know, in terms of the homeowners there.
Exactly. And maybe just one last comment on that. We do see the investment case with some of these new, let's call it startup companies. I'm not sure if playing on an occurrence reinsurance program would be the right place to be. We fundamentally believe that if such an investment case makes sense, and that's maybe the more so towards Evelyn, I would probably even take an equity stake in such a company rather than being the reinsurance supplier for these structures, or both, at least.
Maybe Jessica?
Yeah.
Your view?
I mean, first, just to comment on the reforms. I mean, obviously, they haven't been tested in a major event yet, but you're certainly seeing efficacy of them within attritional losses or, you know, small weather patterns that have gone through the state. So we're certainly encouraged. It's not completely eroded the way we look at litigation. Litigation is still allowed. You've just taken away all the incentives, which I think is the key. It's not free to try these things out. So it's brought our view of risk down as it relates to some of the litigation, social inflation type concerns. And I think it's in the state's best interest to uphold those. I mean, you're finally seeing insurance companies be able to pass through rate decreases in some of their filings. And that's got to be welcome for policyholders within the state. And again, reinsurance capital, I think, sits as a form of capital for these insurance companies, and you're seeing more interest come back to that, which is healthy for the state of the market. For the state of the market. So we're certainly encouraged by it. I think there's lots of signals pointing to success, and you know, would anticipate that sort of continuing. But lots of creative people out there, you know, that are going to try to find ways through. This is just a blocker, so we'll stay vigilant and sort of monitoring what comes next or what state you could see something like this pop up in again.
Okay, thank you very much. So we have 5 minutes left for questions. Could you wait for the microphone before? Thank you.
I wanted to follow up on something that Raphael alluded to, which... having been in the market for 29 years, I'll tell you, I've seen the market go through many cycles. And one of the concerns when you end up hitting this part of the cycle is that people start broadening out the perils and the structures in a way that sometimes deviates from where the risk analysis is as well developed as it may be in the property cat sector. So I'm curious if you have any views with respect to some of the casualty sidecars that are out in the market and the sorts of investors that those are being marketed to and the potential impact on the market itself. And as well, you know, picking on the life guys for a second, as a life guy, you know, some of the life and annuity sidecars as well, where the analysis may not be unbiased given that it's coming from consultants that maybe working on the side of the issuer of said sidecars. So curious about the impact to the extent mistakes are made this time around in the cycle again, you know, perpetuating what we've seen in other cycles in previous decades.
I think you asked and gave the answer kind of at the same time, or I echo the message that I perceive that you make. That said, I'll try to make the case before when I said not all structure, not all perils are for all investors. I think that's key as a principle. Then on the casualty ILS, in general, as an innovation, again, I can easily comprehend that that's a potential path to go. Now, where it comes in the timing in the market, when the property cat gets a bit or seems to be softening, then you start to come up with something new. So the motivation cannot be because one is potentially less attractive. We'll try to find something else where we don't exactly know how it works, but it may seem attractive, right? That can be then challenging. First point. Second point, I think one key consideration in the casualty ILS and some benefits that it offers in terms of leveraging the premium over time is that you have to be very careful about is it really still diversifying or independent of any other financial market situation. This is really one key principle of this asset class. So I also had some conversations that maybe we try to find another name than casualty ILS, because ILS seems to be connected with diversification and independence from financial market. It's called casualty reinsurance transaction, as an example, or something else. I'm not, but it has to be clear what this offers and what it does not offer, right? And then you may find investors that say, hey, I can make healthy double-digit return if things go well, or less if things not go well. That's fine. It's just be clear what it offers, what it does not offer, especially to some sort of key themes that the asset class offers per se and made basically this happening today, right? And you can take it from there. So, and similar on the life. Again, it's the timing. Why do these perils come up now? And are we careful enough in selling the right benefits and the right risks? If we do that, perfectly fine. If we start to kind of, you know, be a bit vague and rely a little bit on hope, that's where then we probably harm the industry on the longer term rather than evolve and get a more mature environment.
There will be a panel later that covers other type of perils, so I guess they can answer that your question. So there is a question here.
Jessica, I wanted to ask you a question about one of the comments you made about the premium on public versus private ILS, and you used the reference of public versus private equity. If I understood it correctly, I think the argument is that there isn't that much premium in the ILS between private and public. My question is actually other side of the table, which is, therefore, if you are a sponsor, does that mean that there is no benefit to issuing a CAD bond where the terms are a lot more restrictive and one should just tap into private capital in the private form? Why bother with CAD bonds if there is no premium and there's no benefit for a sponsor?
Sure. My first point on the private versus equity is I actually think there is quite a lot of premium for the differential between being in private ILS versus cap bonds as an investor. I think you can take a very similar risk profile and generate 300-400 basis points more simply by transacting in that structure. It's a larger marketplace. Cap bonds make up 10% of the overall reinsurance market. I think there's a lot of yield that you can extract beyond what you get just investing in bonds. To your point as an issuer, I think it totally comes down to what's the risk-return trade-off that you're looking to seek and what your objectives are of transferring that risk to the market. Obviously, bonds can have some tighter definitions around their coverage, et cetera. So is the broader all-peril coverage inherent in a private ILS contract or an over-the-counter reinsurance trade, does that satisfy what your needs are versus what you get in a bond? I think Michael pointed as well, the time to issuance to come to the market, it's very rigid in terms of what's offered. There's costs associated with it. So it's absolutely a useful tool. And I really don't mean it to say that there's only good parts of the market or bad. All of them are sort of subsegments of the market. And we like to look at the market and think about what is the relative value that we can get from each of those different instruments. And the more options you have and the more tools you have, the better you can construct a portfolio or outperform the market over the long term. So we could be on the buy side of bonds, we could be on the sell side of bonds at any given point. It's really going to be more what is the relative return we're getting per unit of risk that will dictate which side of that we might choose to play. So
thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Please thank our panelists. And
thanks.